It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin is seeing record high turnover rates for teachers. We'll find out what's driving that change and what districts can do about it. First, one out of every three local election workers around the country has reported being harassed or threatened for doing their job. That's according to a new nationwide survey conducted by the Brennan Center for Justice. Election workers also report worrying about political leaders interfering in election administration and the possibility of feeling pressured to certify results in favor of a specific party or candidate. Those concerns may be fueling turnover. Over one in five local election officials around the country has left or is considering resigning before the 2024 election. Wisconsin lawmakers are working on some bipartisan legislation aimed at boosting protections for election workers. Our next guest says now is the time to act. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more protections for election officials and poll workers? Have you ever served as a poll worker? Are you a regular on that job? What's your experience been like? Have you seen concerns about harassment? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Edgar Lynn is Wisconsin state policy advocate and counsel at Protect Democracy. Previously, he was an assistant state public defender here in Wisconsin. Edgar, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me here.
Before we get to these recommendations here in Wisconsin and possible legislation, this poll from the Brennan Center shows a lot of concern, it seems like, from election workers around the country when it comes to things like harassment. Were you surprised to see those results?
You know, I am not. I think anecdotally, we have heard a lot of stories, people being followed home at night, people's livelihood being threatened, harassment, doxing, people releasing information of election officials online. This survey just sort of reinforces that. It shows that it's consistent to the stories that we're listening to.
When you're hearing these stories from people, is there a sense that it's worse than it used to be, or has it been like this all along? We're just starting to pay attention.
Well, I think since 2020, this level of harassment and intimidation has certainly escalated. I think what we want to ensure is that our election workers and officials, when they go to work, they don't bring home threats to themselves and their families. And that's something happening across the country, including here in Wisconsin.
That's leading some people to leave either local election jobs or maybe stop being poll workers. That Brennan Center, one in five local election officials have left that job or considering leaving before the big election, November of 2024. What are some of the concerns if we have maybe higher than usual turnover in these positions?
So, this gap in workforce can be quite devastating in our country's highest stake election next November. Just imagine whatever work you're engaged in, whether you're in the public sector or in business, think about the consequences if your capacity is reduced by 20% or if 20% of your workers are completely brand new onboarding. Except instead of a business or a nonprofit, it's our system of government and essentially our way of life as a democratic society.
We are talking about election workers and election officials, their safety from harassment. Edgar Lynn is with us with the group Protect Democracy, looking at possible changes here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about some of these concerns about poll workers and election officials? Are we talking about you? Have you worked polls before? Do you plan to next year? Do you see these incidents of harassment? Do you think they're on the rise? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's turn now, Edgar, to the state legislature. You recently wrote a piece that appeared in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel looking at changes in the legislature. What kind of things do you have your eye on when it comes to the prospects for bipartisan laws?
Sure. I think what we can do, and many states have done across this country, is to fortify our laws to protect election officials. A comprehensive legislative package that would have significant impact would include four pillars. And these four are: one, adequate funding and training to support our election workers' physical safety; two, prohibitions against intimidation and harassment-related bad acts, 3 privacy protections against doxing. And for people who are not familiar with that term, doxing means essentially maliciously revealing your private personal information online for harassment purposes. And 4, finally, civil causes of action for harassment and doxing.
How much of that appears in this, and again, this is in the early stages in this legislation, the works in Wisconsin?
Right now, I think we are working to improve it. The current version under AB 300 has 3 portions. One is a whistleblower protection for election officials, a enhanced battery, basically enhanced punishment for people who physically assault election workers, and a open records protection for them against open records for their personal identifying information. So there's still work to be done on this, but I'm very hopeful that we're taking the right steps.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Evie is with us in Chicago. Sorry, Evie. Evie is with us in Chicago. Evie, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
Tell and also hope. We had a lot of problems, a former judge of election here in Chicago, in Cook County, and we had a lot of problems getting judges, getting poll workers to polls during COVID, to get them to polls and open up the polls and keep them open.
Evie, thanks for the call. Evie reporting from her work in Chicago. COVID made it hard to begin with to recruit election officials, she says. Is that also a concern, Edgar, now in the climate of harassment? Is it going to just make it harder to get that person maybe to make their first trip, their first effort to be a poll worker?
I think so. I think, look, it comes down to this. There are threats to election officials, right? This causes election officials to leave. If there's no replacement, election administration will be compromised, making it less secure, less efficient, and along with all the consequences that come with having a lesser workforce. So I think, you know, whether it's COVID, whether it's harassment, those are all factors that can impact, recruitment for election workers.
We're talking to Edgar Lynn, Wisconsin State Policy Advocate and Counsel at the group Protect Democracy, looking at high turnover rates among local elected officials, possible changes in Wisconsin law to protect poll workers ahead of the 2024 election. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you personally witnessed harassment or intimidation at a polling place? How was that resolved? What kind of legal protections do you think are needed to keep election workers safe? If you have worked the polls here in Wisconsin or elsewhere, I'd love to hear your perspective on this. Or if you are or were an election official, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about election workers facing increased harassment and threats on the job and new legal protections in a proposed law in the state legislature. Our guest is Edgar Lynn, Wisconsin State Policy Advocate and Counsel at the group Protect Democracy. He says he's glad to see the law legislature taking up these issues, hoping for more, though, in the package of legislation. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see? What do you want to see done to prevent harassment and threats against election officials and poll workers? If you've worked in those jobs yourself, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we go back to our callers, Edgar, in that piece I mentioned that you wrote on these issues, you say you're encouraged. You see a lot of potential for bipartisan support for these kind of protections. What do you see out there around the country?
Yeah, so there are states similar to Wisconsin that has divided governments, such as Arizona, Nevada. They have been able to work in a bipartisan manner to pass, comprehensive bipartisan election protection bills. And so that's encouraging. For example, in Nevada, it makes it SB 406 makes it illegal under state law to threaten or dox an election official. This passed both chambers unanimously, and a Republican governor signed it at a public ceremony. In Arizona, the bill was introduced by a Republican, passed both chambers and with overwhelming bipartisan support, and it was then signed by a Democratic governor. So I see that there is potential. There's a movement behind this. 75% of the electorate supports protecting our election officials. It's good policy, and people like it.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Ray is with us in West Allis. Ray, hi.
Hi, Rob. I worked the 2020 election for the first time because I saw that the local election workers, in my recollection, were much older than I was at the time, and they were dropping out. They were not showing up for work, and so they had to shrink the number of polling places, and they were hungry for volunteers. So I volunteered, and I enjoyed the process a great deal, and I was really proud of our process because it's all from the ground up. It's all local volunteers and the local city clerk and the local lawyer. And it's all done, I think, very well. Well, since then, I've only worked two more and I haven't been called back. And I found out that in the state of Wisconsin, the political parties can nominate poll workers for municipalities. And the municipalities must use those workers before they ask for volunteers. And I think that's terrible. I think that's the attempt by the political parties to commandeer the system. I would rather see it go back to just local volunteers.
Ray, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for stepping up, by the way, when you were needed in 2020. Appreciate that. Edgar, do you have thoughts on the way we get our poll workers? In some cases, yes, parties can have people on either side to watch for potential concerns. Ray wants to see more people like himself stepping up.
I don't have any specific thoughts on that. The real issue that we are looking at, or the issue we're taking a hard look at, is protecting everyone. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican poll worker or a Democrat poll worker. Nobody should be harassed and intimidated for just doing their job as election workers. People who work in people who are election workers are our neighbors, our family, and our friends. And so the protection should be, you know, the protection will protect all parties and all volunteers. And I think that having those protections will significantly improve our election administration.
Thanks for that call, Ray, at 800-642-1234. Edgar Lynn is with us from the group Protect Democracy. He's their Wisconsin State Policy Advocate and Counsel, looking at protecting poll workers and local election officials from threats and harassment. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Edgar, let's talk about the resources side of things. What kind of funding, what kind of protections do you want to see funded by the state legislature? How far do we have to go to get from where we are to where you want to be?
Yeah. So there's several parts to this. Ultimately, it's making sure that our election workers are safe. So looking at the physical side, if you're looking at fortifying election offices or polling location, proposals have been put out nationwide about, for example, bulletproofing election offices, having panic alarms system, key card access control, fireproofing early vote storage facilities. For anybody who's seen Succession, there was a nightmare scenario there, you know, or on another aspect, services that protect election workers' personal identifying information. So there can be a lot of ways to fund their protections. There's no one size fit all, but I believe that there is some interest and appetite for this as well in the legislature.
Does the mere act of passing some legislation, even if it doesn't go all the way, help send a bipartisan message to people about our hopes for how we treat poll workers and election officials?
I think that's exactly the point, Rob, is that election workers want to feel valued. They want to feel safe. They want to feel like our legislators care about them. And so passing legislation that protects them will give them that reassurance. And so, yes, I the answer to your question is yes.
Let's bring on another caller. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hello.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to respectfully disagree a little bit with your optimism about this bipartisanship. In Wisconsin, anyway, and I've got quite a few years of poll working under my belt, so to speak. The Republican majority legislature has been going after the top election officials and essentially making them look like they're guilty without ever being charged with anything. And I think that when they do that, they're going to leave the regular, us worker ant folks completely unprotected. We're going to be fair game.
Randy, thanks for the call. Edgar, what do you think?
Yeah, the optimism is well, perhaps we're too optimistic, but I will say this, that under the new campaign and election committee, under the new chair, that I have seen real and serious discussions about bipartisan work. And this isn't, while there may be, politicking when it comes to top election officials, we have to remember we have 1,800 plus election officials across the states. Many of them are constituents of both parties, obviously. And so I do think that we can be optimistic, even though there may be political jockeying on the top.
Randy, thanks for that call. In our last minute or so, Edgar, what are you hoping ends up in place by November of 2024, the big election I think most of us have our eyes on right now?
Thanks, Rob. What I'm hoping that could end up is a comprehensive package to protect our election officials, to make sure that they're safe doing their jobs, to make sure that they are physically protected, to make sure that they are not being doxxed, that their personal information is not plastered online for people to harass, to make sure that their children aren't threatened, and so that we can have a swift and efficient administration of our election.
Edgar, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Edgar Lynn, Wisconsin State Policy Advocate and Counsel at the group Protect Democracy, where he focuses on policy advocacy and litigation that relate to preventing election subversion. We've been talking about high turnover rates and increased threats to safety for election officials and what Wisconsin lawmakers can do about it. As we've mentioned, there is some legislation in the works in the Wisconsin State Legislature. Still time for you to share your thoughts, maybe your experiences as a poll worker yourself. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. A longstanding program in Milwaukee offers teens a way to spend their summer evenings. Corrine Hess reports that's especially important now as children have been the victims of homicide more than a dozen times this year.
Huge industrial fans are blowing in a sweltering gym at Milwaukee's Bayview High School. It's a Wednesday night in July, about a month before school starts, and the gym here is full of middle schoolers. They're playing board games, working on math and reading worksheets, or playing basketball. They're part of the Twilight program put on by the Milwaukee Recreation Department. Twilight keeps kids off the streets from 5:30 to 9 p.m. during the summer. Now that the school year has started in Milwaukee, the program will run three nights a week. Isaiah Powell has been here almost every night this summer. His favorite activity is swimming, but on this particular night, he made a t-shirt.
It was supposed to be a bird, but I messed it up. I need to add the wings and finish coloring it.
For the city, Twilight feels especially important this year. After a spike during the pandemic, violent crime has declined in 2023. But as of mid-August, 15 minors have died by homicide this year in Milwaukee. Across town at North Division High School, about 60 high school kids are on the basketball court. They're getting ready for a tournament later this week. Jason Blocker runs the North Division program. He says it's an asset to Milwaukee because Twilight gives young people a place to go.
These kids know that they can come in here Monday through Friday for about 3 hours and have a safe place, no trouble, and then get something out of it, like this basketball league.
Most of the kids in Twilight are Black. Blocker, who's also Black, grew up in Milwaukee. He says he knows these are the kids who are most at risk.
I feel that probably are troubled or have issues, but I mean, here we don't really see the issues because sports doesn't have or discriminates against anybody or sees racism.
Flocker says the key is reaching them where they're at and at the right time.
That 6 to 9 time is a high crime time because the kids are out of school. You know, if you're not a leader, you're a follower. So you might be following somebody else or a big brother or somebody that's in your neighborhood that's leading you to no good.
The youth program isn't new. 20 years ago, the program began under the name Summer Stars. It was originally funded through a city grant. Once the grant concluded, Summer Stars was retooled and Twilight launched in 2017. Back at Bayview High School, 11-year-old Jamari Moore spins a basketball on one finger several times, letting us know he's one of the best players in the program. Jamari says he is quite possibly the best football player to ever grace that field as well.
I play basketball. I really do love football. I won championship because I had the ball. It was last point win, right? Cross this other person. I went that way. Then went straight. Guess what happened? Touchdown. And guess what? We won.
The Twilight program has been growing. Every year, more parents realize it's available at several sites across Milwaukee, free of charge. And leaders say they're proud that they can help give kids like Jamari such confidence. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, a new report highlights a growing problem of teacher turnover in Wisconsin. An education professor joins the show to look at some of the causes and possible solutions for that trend. And you can let us know what's going on in your part of the state right now. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Is there a last-minute scramble to find teachers in your district? Are you an educator who left the job or left public schools? Let us know why and what you think. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, clinics around Wisconsin have started offering infusions of the drug ketamine as an alternative treatment for depression. A Wisconsin psychoactives researcher will join us to explain how it works, why it's gaining popularity, and address a lot of questions that are still out there. Now, more and more teachers in Wisconsin are changing jobs. According to a new report from the nonpartisan Wisconsin Policy Forum, turnover among teachers rose to just under 16% during the last school year. That rate included both the highest levels on record of teachers moving between districts and the second highest levels of teachers leaving classrooms in Wisconsin's public schools. The Policy Forum analysis found that turnover was highest in districts that serve lower-income students, and it was highest among teachers of color. Among other things, there's concern that this kind of turnover can lead to inconsistency and instability in the classroom at a time when many students are still feeling ripple effects from pandemic learning loss. We're learning more about what might be driving high teacher turnover, what impact it's having, and what districts might be able to do about it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing this kind of teacher turnover in your local school district? What do you think is behind that? If you're a teacher yourself, have you recently changed jobs or left the profession altogether? Share your experience. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Gardner Seawright is an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Foundations at UW-Whitewater and a former middle school teacher. Gardner, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
We've been hearing some concerns about teacher retention over the years, but at least according to this report, we've seen this jump. What do you think might be behind that?
I think there's a lot of things that could be behind it. I think, you know, looking at the trends over time is really important here, especially considering that, like, this is not entirely new and not entirely surprising given the trends over time, considering that there's been a relatively high rate of turnover just over the last 10 years. But then it is quite concerning that it jumped to the high rate of for 2023. So I am concerned about it, but I think the things that we are seeing that are leading to it. I think it's to start off is really important to kind of deal with the popular presumption that turnover like this is kind of from out of control students and resentful teachers of those out of control students. But recent research, including the policy brief that just came out, really points to poor working conditions, organizational culture, and dissatisfaction as central contributors to turnover. And it's not really the fault of students.
Before we dig it more into the causes, let's talk about the consequences. I think the expectation is schools are mostly going to end up with the staffing they need, might be down to the wire. Does it affect students if there's a higher level of turnover in the staff that's showing up in the classrooms from year to year?
100%. You know, that is the real problem here. It's like, yes, we are concerned about, you know, teachers are workers, and we want them to have positive, supportive working environments. But at the end of the day, the people who feel the brunt of teacher turnover are the students. And so, and especially in the districts where we need the most experienced teachers, that's where we're seeing these highest turnover rates. In those districts, students are hurting because of this rate, because you are having fewer teachers with the amount of experience needed to teach, like from an asset-based perspective, from a community-driven perspective, who have like a trauma-informed idea of how to work with students who are going through things like a major pandemic. So there is also just like a bulk of research showing that just there are just negative learning outcomes from high teacher turnover and just high teacher stress.
My mom is a retired teacher. She taught in my district for many, many years. Some of the students who graduated with me from high school, well, they came back and taught there, and she was the one training them. How much do we lose if we don't have that, at least a core of long-term teachers sharing that institutional knowledge with the next generation?
Well, the institutional knowledge is key, right? But one of the hard things here is that sharing in that institutional knowledge is not always formalized. So we don't have as many formal mentorship programs that we should have, especially in the districts that need kind of a specific set of teaching skills, like working in our city districts and our urban districts with our students who might be experiencing assortments of trauma in their lives.
Gardner C. Wright is with us from the Department of Educational Foundations at UW-Whitewater, looking at this new report showing a jump in turnover among teachers in Wisconsin's public schools, moving either from one school to another or moving from teaching in a classroom to doing something different altogether. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as a parent or student in a district. Are you seeing a lot of new unfamiliar faces showing up because of this? If you work in schools, what's your experience there? What do you think is behind this? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Gardner, you laid out a short list of some of the possible causes of this kind of turnover, including working conditions for teachers in schools. What kind of concerns do you have that could be driving this level of turnover?
So in terms of working conditions, you have to look at, yes, like the kind of baseline, like what are the facilities like? You know, MPS, like Milwaukee Public Schools, is in dire need of some kind of facilities upgrades. There's a lot of schools that don't have basic air conditioning, and that's across the state. So, you know, there are the basic things that additional funding from the legislature could help. But you also have things like how the organizational structure of schools, and there's actually a lot of research that the organizational structure actually matters more than a lot of other factors. So things like how much are teachers actually listen to? How much input do they have in the decision-making process? How much do their administration leaders actually listen to them? What influence do they have over their curriculum? What kind of autonomy do they have in the classroom? You know, we've over the last, you know, couple of decades of educational policy reform, we've seen teacher autonomy become more and more constricted. And I think you see a lot of teacher frustration just in like that they don't have the time to do really creative and exciting things in their classroom. And there is there are fewer opportunities to have autonomy in their classroom the way they should and kind of treated like the professional that they are.
A concern I remember hearing in the past, Gardner, is that, you know, you might have some well-funded school district, maybe in a growing suburban area, the tax base is increasing, the number of students is going up. They can afford to pay a teacher more than, say, a rural district where you're seeing lower student enrollment. And, you know, if a teacher wants to make a little more to progress in their career, they might not be able to do it within that small district. So they head to that, this hypothetical example, the wealthier suburban district. Is that part of the story here?
So that is part. So direct compensation, at least in Milwaukee, at least in Wisconsin, it doesn't really shake out that way. Because so Milwaukee Public Schools is the highest paying district in the state. It might be really close with Madison. But where the disparity lies between suburban districts and city districts is in the resources that they're able to provide. So the disparity in funding doesn't necessarily come down to direct compensation in terms of salary, but in terms of like what type of donations can wealthy community members give in terms of like physical facilities or fundraisers that go directly to fund clubs and extra activities. So that's where you see a lot of the disparities show up. And ultimately, those are like really important parts of an educational experience. And they also, when students have a lot of things going on, that ultimately that gives teachers more to work with as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Joe is with us in Spooner. Joe, hi.
Yeah, hi there. I taught for 24 years in a suburb of Minneapolis, St. Louis Park School District. It was my second career. I'm a retired Marine Corps officer also and decided to go into public education. I taught English. In 2013, I took a leave of absence and went and taught in China for 3 years. And when I came back, the culture of my building had changed dramatically. Cell phones had proliferated throughout. There were liberal policies, and I use that term very loosely because I consider myself a progressive. Policies of the generic terms of under the guide on of equity and diversity, and I support those. But those issues supplanted what really was essential, and that was the rigorous curriculum that I experienced before I went to China. And when I came back, that went out the window, and the whole building focus became about socio-emotional aspects of children and teaching them about alternative histories and things like that, rather than, you know, straight up ABCs, teaching reading and writing and staying focused on a rigorous curriculum, because I think that's the most equitable thing of all.
Joe, thanks a lot for the call. Gardner, Joe, worried about changes he saw there, and I imagine there are a lot of teachers one way or another who may not like the way that the trends in teaching go over time.
Yeah, and then, so Joe's experience there is, you know, he hit on a lot of major factors that are under debate right now, and I think what he's talking about with kind of like classic rigorous curriculum, I want to focus on that for a second, because that is that's been a point of conversation that's been frequently touted in the current kind of debates around equity, diversity, and inclusion. And that's where I think we have to think about like what is rigorous. And that's where, you know, there's a kind of classic style of kind of that is focused more on rote engagement. Okay, memorize these dates, these facts, these timetables, these kind of formulas, and it is focused on that rote memorization and regurgitation on high-stakes standardized tests, where we tend alongside kind of a push for more equity-based curriculum, culturally relevant curriculum, you also see a push for a more critical in-depth engagement with specific topics. And that does look different. It's not the same kind of super fast-paced engagement with lesson after lesson after lesson, where you're supposed to remember a specific set of facts. But there's a lot of research supporting that kind of in-depth engagement with materials that does look a little different actually promotes more long-term retention, more critical thinking, and ultimately has positive results for like what we want out of students. But ultimately, I think it really comes down to like big philosophical questions of like, what do we think the purpose of education is, and what do you hope students are going to get? Do you want them to have this kind of list of facts, or do you want them to be deep critical thinkers?
Joe, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. We're talking to UW-Whitewater education professor Gardner C. Wright about turnover among teachers in Wisconsin. It's up, according to a recent report. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think school districts could do, should do to retain teachers? Do you want to see more from the state legislature and the governor on this? If you're a current or former educator yourself, love to hear what you've seen. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Gardner C. Wright, assistant professor in the Department of Educational Foundations at UW-Whitewater, looking at the turnover rate for teachers in Wisconsin, why it has gone up, what impact that can have. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is driving teachers to leave districts, to leave teaching? Are we talking about you? Tell us about your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jack is with us in Spring Lake, Michigan. Jack, hi.
Hi, how are you, sir?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, my name is Dr. Jack Drennan, PhD hypnotherapy, master psychology, master's education, and the first thing, always a teacher. Just because you have a piece of paper doesn't mean you're any good at what you do. But moving from there to the students, I started teaching in inner city Detroit. And I grew up in a tough inner city family with a military dad. And as I taught, I found out, and I later moved to a suburban school because they recruited me. Not I recruited them, but I found out that after a couple years, I needed to go back and get a master's in psychology. And because the number, I would have 40 students in my class, overload, and the other teacher teaching the same thing would have 15. Now, what was the difference? The difference is every student wrote down everything they felt I needed to know about them on the first day of class. Second thing, I was always at the door and thanking them for coming to school. Your goal is for day one is for students to look forward to coming to day two and day three and day four. You know, so we did crazy things. They got all their homework done. They hit me in the face with three pies.
Jack, thanks for the call. Jack, it sounds like Gardner, it sounds like Jack put a lot of heart and soul into his teaching. What is it that we need to do to have teachers prepared for maybe a difficult situation, whether it's an inner city school district, as Jack said, or a lot of students? Do we have enough preparation in there for them getting hit in the pie, notwithstanding?
So I think there's two things that are really important to underlying that story. And first is like, so that he went back to get his master's degree. That type of thing needs to have formal support. So like things like state tuition reimbursements for not only like new teachers going through initial teacher education, but like going back and seeking additional credentials. That is such a huge bonus for districts that we as a state, we should really be supporting more options to fund teachers to improve their skill set. But then on the backside of just like him having that heart and trying to, and like that actually reminds me of another part of the report that we're talking about today, that Black teachers and teachers of a color are overrepresented in turnover. And the reasons for this are the same as the others, but that there's a lot of stress in teaching, but there's also for a lot of teachers of color, there is additional uncompensated labor force attached to the work that they do with students of color. So this is like when you have a Black teacher come in, there's a there is both an explicit and implicit assumption that they're going to serve as like mentors, de facto counselors, community liaisons, disciplinarians, curriculum specialists for Black and Brown communities across the state. That is an additional amount of work that we need to recognize that increases burnout, because like they are bringing an additional skill set, because there's also a tremendous amount of research identifying the positive academic achievements attached to having a more diverse workforce. When teachers come in and are able to see the strengths and the assets of the communities that they're working with, that goes a long way to working with students so they can create lessons and engage them in ways where they are excited to come into class every day. And that's huge. And what I'm saying is that we need to find formal ways to compensate those skill sets and the additional labor that we put on Black teachers and teachers of color.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth joins us now in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just retired as a teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing after 41 years and have seen a lot of changes, big changes in Wisconsin that I think contribute to burnout. Teacher burnout is, you know, we have a new teacher evaluation system where teachers now get not only observed, but we have to upload documents. We have to comment on documents. It's like a whole extra process that teachers have to add in addition to their load of teaching and a lot of requirements from the Department of Public Instruction that are, I wish some of these people would actually go into a school and see what, you know, is involved. Also, the population of students has changed. There's parental support may not be as high as it was back in the day. I think people, the general public, think that kids come to school, they get their breakfast, they have a lovely home life, everything is fine and dandy. That is not the case with a lot of students. So these students are coming with a lot of trauma, especially after COVID. There's just a lot being put on teachers.
Elizabeth, I got you. We don't have a ton of time left, but thanks for sharing your experience. Gardner, Elizabeth, pointing to, you know, it's not just standing up in front of the class and teaching. It's a lot of back-end bureaucracy that we don't see, she says, and a lot of challenges with the students themselves in some cases.
You know, I think, you know, there's two things going on there. And, like, the back-end bureaucracy is one thing. And, yes, and I want to come back to that. But I think, like, yeah, like, students are dealing with a lot of trauma, including, you know, a global pandemic that we're both coming back from. And I think, you know, teachers do need to be better prepared with trauma-informed approaches of, like, how to work with students who have been experiencing things like a loss of a loved one, or even dealing with the trauma associated with structural racism or poverty. These are all sources of trauma that teachers need to be prepared to kind of work with students to and support them while they're dealing with that in schools. And basically, you know, students come into a classroom with a lot of life behind them. And I think what teachers need to be prepared to do that. And there needs to be also administrative support once they are teachers to engage that kind of stuff. But to our caller's point about like the teaching evaluation systems, I think it's actually a good point to consider when it comes to actually the presence of unions in districts across the country. So there's a significant amount of research pointing out that in districts with a high density of teacher unionization, I actually have fewer amounts of stress. And I bring this up because if you think about like the thing, if you think about the point around teacher evaluation systems as part of collective bargaining agreements, you teachers can have say over those type of evaluation systems. That's part of the whole system. And so, you know, so there's some good research showing that unionization actually reduces teacher stress, as well as compensating like additional salary compensation. In Wisconsin, teacher salary has kind of adjusted for inflation, has kind of decreased 8% since the passage of Act 10. So I think there's like in terms of how the public, as well as administrators and policymakers, can support teachers, there's always the option of like, how can we move forward and reconsider teacher unionization?
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Gardner Seawright from UW-Whitewater, with us today to look at why Wisconsin is seeing a record high for turnover among teachers. Hey, here's an idea for a future potential conversation here on Central Time that I'm running across lately. I want to see if you are, too, if it's worth talking about. The topic, what to do with old photos and videos from different formats. Here's what I've got going on. I just digitized some old slides for a relative a couple weeks back. They're pretty old. The slides, I mean. I'm staring every evening at a tote full of old photos, you know, made with film and developed. Working on backing up old videos of my kids, some digital, some on a cassette. Then there's whatever's on my computer and my phone at this point. What do we do with it all? Now, is this something you're dealing with it with? Tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you're working with when it comes to photos and videos, what help you might need, what solutions you've arrived at. That's ideas@WPR.org. If we hear from, I don't know, a couple few people, then this is maybe a thing. We'll talk about it. If it's just me, well, I'll keep dealing with it on my own time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to The Ideas Network from Wisconsin Public Radio.